All right. We'll start with 30. Perhaps it will go faster. And I think if we follow the same, fellow judges agree, have you address them in the same order.
May it please the court, Deborah Bernal again, on behalf of the secretary. Starting with argument one in appellant's brief about revision of August 1994 VA decision on the basis of clear and unmistakable error. In the secretary's brief, we had argued that this argument had been abandoned because appellant did not assert any merit-based argument about his Q claim. We would stick with that. Assuming the board had jurisdiction, as the court pointed out, there was a regional office decision.
Was there a statement of the case?
I thought the court had identified a statement of the case earlier.
No.
I thought we were talking about whether or not there was a substantive appeal. Question about whether or not there was a substantive
appeal. Well, was it one of those?
I think that the record at 3349 could be broadly construed as a substantive appeal because appellant says, again, reiterates his argument for revision of all previous decisions based on errors.
And what does that record say again?
3349. Said in the, this is a statement that he submitted in lieu of a VA Form 9. Mr. Bradley is entitled to revision of the prior decisions of the VA, which failed to note and award disability compensation for all, in bold, of the disabilities suffered by Mr. Bradley at discharge from service. And I believe that the August 1994 decision encompasses at least a good portion of those injuries.
You're referring to the second paragraph on that record site, is that correct?
I was referring to the first paragraph on page 3349.
The first paragraph.
Yeah, Mr. Bradley is entitled to revision of the prior decisions.
Okay.
So if this is considered a Form 9 and there was already a notice of disagreement, which was previously discussed with Mr. Carpenter, the board would have had jurisdiction over the issue. And as Mr. Carpenter conceded, he did not argue to the board that it was not an issue that he was not interested in having them adjudicate. So they did adjudicate it, and then before this court in his brief, essentially abandoned any merit-based argument regarding that Q claim.
That's one. Number two.
Okay. Your Honors, issue number two is, as framed in the appellant's brief, is Mr. Bradley's claim for an earlier effective date of November 21st, 1969.
Recall there are the three subsets to his argument. The first is that the claim in 69 never got fully adjudicated. The second is the revision under 3.105B. And the third is this increased rating.
Okay.
Do you have comments on each of those?
With regard to the assertion that the claim never got adjudicated in 1969, I believe appellant is, there was a rating decision in 1970. It was based on an examination that identified, as was pointed out, multiple different scars, but he was only rated for, compensably rated for two injuries. The argument that those claims that were identified in the medical evidence but not rated at that time remain active has been settled, essentially, by the Federal Circuit and DeShottle. The appropriate method for Mr. Bradley to challenge the unadjudicated claims that he perceives is through a Q motion, and that's not what we have before us here.
The recommendation for revision, do you have any comments on that?
The difference of opinion. Yes, sir. VA manual provisions are pretty clear that the difference of opinion regulation applies when a VA rating decision or decision review officer decision is not final. It's a difference of opinion within the agency before the decision becomes final. Perhaps a common situation apparently is when a rating supervisor is reviewing a rating decision and notes a difference of opinion, it can be referred to the central office. The secretary's position on this issue is that this court's case law is very clear that the only way to challenge an otherwise final decision is through a clear and unmistakable error motion or through the presentation of new material evidence. And in this particular instance, Mr. Bradley is trying to use 3.105B as an alternative method of filing a Q claim. And these decisions that...
Well, what if he filed a claim that said, Mr. RO, I think that should be revised. Request you review that. I claim that should be revised and you should review it. And the RO says no. Is that a decision by the RO that can be appealed?
Yes, sir. If you filed a claim saying that a rating decision should be revised, that would essentially
for difference of opinion.
That would not be a review. I'm sorry. If you filed a claim that a rating decision should be revised based on difference of opinion, that would not be something that's reviewable because that would be a discretionary determination, and it would only a claim for. There is no claim for a difference of opinion because it's a difference of opinion between adjudicators in the agency before a decision becomes final. If the decision is already final, an appellant is filing a claim saying it should be revised, it would be a Q claim under 3.105A, which I was confused. I thought that that's what you were talking about, and in that case, that would be an appealable decision.
Questions on that? And then finally, the increased rating part.
The claims that the increased ratings are raised by the medical evidence. Again, the secretary's position on that issue is that that also has been is well-settled case law that medical records alone cannot be construed as informal claims. Criswell is a decision of this court that found that at 20 VetApp 501. Also, going back as far to 1998 and Branham versus West, medical evidence is insufficient to raise an original claim. I'm not sure in this particular instance if Mr. Bradley would characterize his claims, any of them, as original, aside from the one that was filed in service, which is characterized as encompassing all of his disabilities. But the medical evidence alone cannot be construed as an informal claim. And even if there are unadjudicated informal claims in this record, without of course conceding that there are any, but assuming for the purpose of this discussion that there would be an informal claim that's unadjudicated, again, the way to challenge that would be through a Q motion.
Any questions? All right.
Now, where does Ingram fit into your analysis here? You relied on DeShotel, and I just wonder, doesn't Ingram change DeShotel? I mean, heavens forbid that we would change DeShotel. Doesn't Ingram provide some interpretive enlightenment with regard to DeShotel?
Perhaps, but in Ingram, this court found that a reasonably raised claim remains pending until there's either a recognition of the claim by the RO from which the claimant could deduce that the claims were adjudicated. Here, the court's case law has been clear that the medical evidence alone without evidence of an intent to file a claim would be insufficient to raise a claim. So we would argue that no original claims can be reasonably raised through the medical evidence. And of course, the DeShotel would be binding still that the RO's failure to address an implied claim is properly challenged through a Q motion.
Okay, but didn't he essentially claim that, you know, I stepped on a booby trap, I got blown up, I was grievously injured, I have all of these fragment wounds, and I'd like for you to appropriately compensate me. And VA said, here's what we're going to give you, A and B, and was silent as to other things that were in the medical record.
Yes, sir, that's correct. But the examination that was the basis of the original rating in 1970 found most of his scars to be superficial, and he was rated for the tender and painful scars. And he disagreed with that. He could have filed a notice of disagreement, and he didn't. Later, when he obtained representation from Mr. Carpenter, the 1970 rating decision, I believe, 1971, there's a April of 1973, February of 76, December of 76, February of 82, and November of 82, all of those rating decisions, which in Mr. Bradley's assertion did not adequately evaluate his scar and muscle injuries, were challenged on the basis of Q. And in January 1997, the board issued a decision finding no Q in any of those rating decisions. The board's January 1997 decision has not been challenged on the basis of Q, at least not yet.
Okay. All right. moving on to what is the next one?
I believe the next one.
The right to separate compensable ratings. I understand that the secretary agrees with the appellant that it should be remanded with regard to scars, but not to muscles. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Do you want to?
With regard to the scars specifically, in a 2004 decision in Jones, the court pointed out inconsistencies in the language of Diagnostic Code 7804 that it wanted the agency to address in the first instance that are implicated here in terms of whether or not multiple scars in the same anatomical area could be rated multiple times under that diagnostic code. In January of 2008, this year, VA's published a proposed rule in the Federal Register to rewrite that section and various other sections regarding the skin that would rate the scars in the same anatomical area separately to some degree. And as I understand it, it's been comments were received, and it's been forwarded to the Office of Management and Budget for signature.
What about the muscle?
The muscle, the secretary does not concede remand on, Your Honor. I believe that appellant's argument is that every single one of the 38 different muscle injuries should receive a separate rating. And our position is that the rating schedule has already grouped the different muscle injuries into 23 different muscle groups in five anatomical regions, and that if you refer to 38 CFR 4.55, D, E, and F, it specifies how to rate multiple muscle injuries in the same muscle group. And if they affect the same joint, the evaluation for the most severely injured muscle group is increased by one level and used as the combined evaluation. And if they affect different joints, the muscle injuries are rated separately and then combined under the combined rating table at 38 CFR 4.25. So again, our position is that the rating schedule has already addressed the issue of how separate muscle injuries within the same muscle group are to be rated.
Counsel, does the January 2008 rewrite include a muscle group rewrite as well or not?
Just scars, Your Honor.
Okay.
My understanding is that when that's signed, when that's signed by the Office of Management and Budget, which is what is the next step, then it'll be published as a final rule in the Federal Register. Okay. If there are no further questions, I'll turn to the issue of the special monthly compensation. Section 1114S provides special monthly compensation at a housebound rate when a claimant has a service-connected disability rated as total and service-connected disabilities or disability or disabilities independently rateable at 60%. And our position is that the appellant does not meet this standard because he does not have a single disability rated as total because none of his multiple disabilities are rated at a scheduler 100%.
Could they be? Shouldn't VA take a look at that? I mean, this is an extra benefit provided by Congress for veterans. why would not VA, when it got raised, at what point it gets raised, I suppose is an issue, but when it gets raised, take a look at what they're given total disability for. If you have a veteran, in this case, who has PTSD at 70%, that might alone be the cause for his total disability. And you have muscle and scars that are the others that don't, at least on their face, seem to indicate that that's the total disability individually. Why wouldn't VA have the duty to go look at that?
Well, sir, our position is that the statute and the regulation are clear that the total rating has to be a 100% scheduler.
Why is the statute clear on that?
Well, the statute says if a veteran has a service-connected disability rated as total and has additional service-connected disabilities independently rated at 60%. Now, if you look at Section J of the statute, again, it uses the word total and it provides the monthly compensation for that disability, for total disability. That's the same disability compensation pay you would receive if you have a TDIU rating or if you have a 100% scheduler compensation rating. I'm sorry.
So it equates them.
It equates them in Section J. But in Section S is different. And I would point out that, as Judge Moorman had pointed out earlier, appellant is not in receipt of TDIU at this time. He had TDIU from March 25th, 1983 to June 8th, 1992. At that point, he has a combined scheduler rating of 100%.
So what does that mean? I mean,
well,
you know, honestly.
Perhaps.
Totally disabled, you can't be employed, but we're going to call it something else and give you this, give you certain benefits, and because we're not calling it TDIU, you don't get it?
Well, there's additional benefits, sir, when a veteran is rated 100% under the schedule as opposed to a total rating for TDIU.
But if he had 100% under the schedule, he would still apply for SMC, would he not, if he had the additional disabilities?
Well, Your Honor, the way I understand it and it has been explained to me is similar to what Mr. Carpenter said, that the VA will automatically rate you under Section S when you meet the qualifications. Our position in this case is that Mr. Bradley has never met the qualifications for Section S, which is why VA has never afforded him the special monthly compensation. He filed his own claim for it in January of 2000. I don't know if that means that the claim's been pending since January of 2000. If it has, he didn't have TDIU at that time. So it may be advisory for the court to consider whether TDIU by itself is sufficient to satisfy the first prong of 1114S. So Mr. Bradley was not in receipt of TDIU at the time he filed his claim. But if I could refer back to the legislative history a bit.
Was he rated 100%?
He was rated for a combined rating of a 100%. He is in receipt currently of a combined rating of 100%, and he has been since June 8, 1992. For all the multiple shrapnel and scar wounds, when combined together with the PTSD, combined together under on the combined rating table to reach a scheduler 100%, which took over on June 8, 1992, when all of his separate scars, not all of his separate scars, but the ones VA has recognized, were separated.
Along those lines, counsel, you have a statement in your brief at 25 that asserts that a combined rating of 100% doesn't qualify for SMC under 1114S. Why?
That, Your Honor, I'd refer you to VA's regulation at 38 CFR 3.350 little I, which says that compensation under 1114S is payable where the veteran has a single service-connected disability rated as 100%. VA's manual provisions mirror that regulation, again, saying that a single disability of 100% is required. If Mr. Bradley's PTSD was rated at 100% by itself, then he would qualify.
Wouldn't he have a combined rating of 100%?
He does, sir.
Then he wouldn't have a single rating of 100%. I mean, your argument to us is because he has a combined rating of 100%, he no longer has a TDIU at 100%.
That's correct.
Well, if he has a combined rating of 100%, he doesn't have a single rating at 100%. He doesn't. Those kind of fall away, and he's just left with a combined rating is what we're hearing.
The VA regulation specifically says compensation provided by 38 U.S.C. 1114S is payable where the veteran has a single service-connected disability, singular use of the word disability, rated as 100%. Our position is that that must be one disability rated as 100%.
Right, but if he had PTSD at 100% and other disabilities, the combined rating would be 100%. Would he have a PTSD rating, single rating at 100%, plus a combined rating at 100%? You'd actually look at his ratings. You wouldn't look at the amount of dollars he's getting, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, under so why is it any different with TDIU? Why doesn't he have a 100% rating of TDIU and a combined rating separate? The combined rating didn't, I mean, I know you said he doesn't get TDIU today, but that doesn't mean he's not TDIU 100% rated. He just has a combined rating, which provides some additional extra benefits, and that's what he's paid under. Doesn't mean he doesn't have TDIU, does it? They never took it away, did they? I mean, did they say you no longer have TDIU, or did they just give you a combined?
Well, sir, what they did was his TDIU rating continued until June 8, 1992, and then it was subsumed by
right, but it wasn't eliminated. I mean, it's not like he doesn't have TDIU. If the 100% schedule went away because miraculously his scar is cured, he'd still have TDIU, wouldn't he?
He still would, sir, but his TDIU was based on the combination of his multiple disabilities,
that's,
so it would still preclude him from a compensation of 1114S.
But why shouldn't VA have the duty to take a look at that? Doesn't this case scream out of the possibility that he's TDIU based on PTSD alone?
Well, Your Honor, the General Counsel Opinion 699 specifically addressed the issue of whether you could be compensated for both TDIU and a scheduler 100% rating for, I believe, PTSD, and concluded that the scheduler rating subsumes the TDIU rating and takes over. They would be there would be no basis for two ratings, one for TDIU and one under the schedule, because the scheduler rating of 100% for a single disability, in particular PTSD, would assume unemployability.
Now, that 99 OGC presidential opinion, as I recall, said that it was clear from a reading of 1114S that TDIU could not qualify. Is that correct?
That is what it said in paragraph 14.
Okay. Now, are you familiar with the OGC precedent opinion from 1994 that said that 1114S clearly did not exclude TDIU and that the reg was changed thereafter in 95, alluding to that GC opinion?
Yes, sir. I'm familiar with that.
Okay. How do you square those two opinions on what seem to be opposite sides of the same question, both asserting that it was clear on the face of the statute that the statute meant two different things that are polar opposites?
It's difficult, sir. But I believe that...
That's an understatement.
Well, I can assure you it was difficult for me.
That's what they pay you for.
Yeah. The 294 General Counsel opinion was solicited for the purpose of determining whether or not total ratings under for convalescence, pre-stabilization, and temporary periods of hospitalization would qualify for the S rate. And ultimately, the General Counsel determined that it would.
It was gratuitous dicta, wasn't it?
That would be our position. And actually, if I could refer you to...
But then, even if it was gratuitous dicta, VA implemented it in its regulation. Am I correct?
Not exactly, sir.
It took out those words.
It did take it out.
Not resulting from TDIU, right?
Yes, sir, it did. But the reason those words were taken out was so that the regulation could conform to 4.28, 4.29, and 4.30, which were the convalescent, pre-stabilization, and temporary hospitalization periods, which were the basis for the General Counsel's opinion in the first place. And unemployability is presumed by virtue of those sections. And the 294 essentially said that that the restriction barring the S rating for unemployability was impermissibly restrictive because it excluded veterans who would have a temporary 100% rating under 4.28, 4.29, or 4.30. And our position is it was not intended to reach as far as a TDIU rating under 4.16, because again, in this type of case, Mr. Bradley's ratings are for a multitude of disabilities, and the statute was clear that a single disability, by using the singular form of the word disability in the first section and then alternating between the singular and the plural form of the word disabilities in the second section of 1114S, it was clear that they intended the first part to apply to only a single disability. And here the TDIU rating was always based on a combination of disabilities. And the single disability argument and the fact that a TDIU rating was never intended to qualify under 1114S is really well supported by the legislative history. And you look back at the committee reports from the House and Senate when the law was enacted, which was in 1960, it was Public Law 8663, I believe, yes. And both the House and Senate committee reports contain comments from the then administrator of the Veterans Administration, where he specifically talks about adding an intermediary level of disability payment for those veterans who are more disabled than the total disabling category, which would now be the J rate, and could not qualify based on the combination of disabilities for the other special monthly compensation sections. And so the S rate was added.
Doesn't the appellant fall within that?
Well, he doesn't, because the way that the committee reports read is that the basis for including this intermediary rate was because the degree of a given disability is based, and then parenthetically it says, pursuant to 38 U.S.C. 355, end paren, as far as practicable on the average impairment in earning capacity resulting from a service such disability in civil occupation, and a veteran is not penalized for overcoming that disability.
What do you read? Which one are you reading from?
I'm reading from the House report accompanying H.R. 7211, and this is the House report supporting Public Law 86663.
And this is the letter to Mr. Teague, or where?
Yes, I am. The letter to Olin Teague from Sumner Whittier. And the reference to 38 U.S.C. 355 is very telling here, because that is the predecessor to, it's been moved, to 38 U.S.C. 1155, which is the authority to implement the scheduler rating, the scheduler rating schedule. Now, TDIU is a regulatory creation that was created by the VA administrator in 1941. And so in 1960, if Congress would have wanted to include TDIU, it could have, but it chose not to. It did not exclude it, but our position is that based on the legislative history and based on the legislative history supporting the implementation of the law, that TDIU was not encompassed in the single disability rated as total in Section 1114S.
So then the General Counsel was wrong in 2004.
With Your Honor, are you referring to the gratuitous dicta?
Yes. that VA implemented in its regulation. And again, you know, Counsel, with regard to the implementation of the Federal Register, when they took out the words without resort to individual unemployability, specifically relied on that General Counsel opinion, found that portions of 38 CFR, referring to the General Counsel opinion, found that portions of 38 CFR 3.350I, which precludes eligibility if the service-connected disability rated as total is so rated due to individual unemployability, is an unauthorized restriction. It seems to me that that's a pretty broad implementation of the General Counsel's opinion. That's not to say that VA doesn't have the authority to reverse course. It just seems to me that it reflects on the clarity of the statutory language. Does it not?
Well, Your Honor, the language, when the final rule was implemented, I agree, is broad. But to the extent that it was overbroad, VA has corrected itself in the VA opinion at 699, and never has the agency ever allowed special monthly compensation for TDIU.
Now, does this court owe deference to that 99 OGC opinion?
I see I'm out of time. If I may continue, the court does not owe deference.
Thank you for asking. You may.
The court does not owe deference, sir. The secretary, of course, is bound by it.
Pardon?
The secretary, of course, is bound by it. The court, however, would owe deference, I believe, to the VA regulation at 38 CFR 3.350 little I, where it says a single service-connected disability rated as numerically 100%, which in and of itself would bar TDIU, and particularly in this case when the TDIU is based on a combination of disabilities and is no longer actually in effect.
And that deference would be as long as the regulation is a reasonable interpretation of the statute?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But the secretary is not bound by his regulation 3.350 that was not changed after the 99 opinion, but was changed to reflect the 94 opinion?
The secretary's position with regard to that issue would be that the change in regulation was to implement the General Counsel Opinion 294, which was solicited really for the sole purpose of determining whether or not a total rating under 4.28, 4.29, or 4.30 was sufficient to qualify for the special monthly compensation benefits under 1114S, because the General Counsel determined that it was, and that the language that a 100% rating under 4.29, 4.28 or 4.30 would be sufficient to get the S rate, the regulation was amended to reflect that. And by removing the phrase individual employability, it broadened the regulation to the extent that the S rate could be provided to those veterans qualifying for benefits under 4.28, 4.29, or 4.30, which again are benefits that are given when a single disability qualifies for those ratings. Here, we still have a combination of disabilities. There is no single disability rated total. Under 4.28, 4.29, or 4.30, a claimant will be given a 100%. They only need a single disability to bump them up to the 100%.
Okay. If you have, can you add, Paul? Could you add 5 minutes to the clock? And if you need more, we'll give it to you. If you had a 100% schedule rating versus a TDIU 100%, I think you said the schedule rating gives it some more benefits. What are those benefits?
Well, if you're rated 100%, you could still theoretically work, and your rating would not be reduced. If you're rated TDIU, you could not obtain anything other than marginal employment, or you would no longer be entitled to TDIU. So that would be the benefit. The other benefit, of course, would be entitlement to the special monthly compensation under Section S.
So if you had the... Okay. All right. Any other questions?
And so the secretary's position then with regard to the combined rating is a combined rating can never be a single rating. And the secretary has defined the application of 1114S as meaning that total is a single disability rated as 100%.
Yes, sir, under the schedule.
Under the schedule, that's correct. Okay.
All right. One more argument.
Chronic pain.
Chronic pain. And counsel's reference to DC 9422.
Well, Your Honor, the diagnostic code that appellant is referring to here At argument, I don't believe was raised in his brief, but it refers to chronic pain syndrome as a mental disorder. It's under the mental disorder section of the rating code, and the diagnosis of chronic pain syndrome was on the 2003 VA examination. The physician referred to it really as a physical manifestation of the scars and the muscle injuries, and the board in its decision and the secretary in the brief all concur that the pain alone caused by the muscle injuries and scars, pain alone is not a separately ratable condition, and to the extent that it is, he's already been compensated for his pain because every single scar that he's compensated for considers pain and tenderness in affording him the 10% rating.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter, you have 5 minutes. You may address any of them unless there's questions.
I was going to say, I actually hope
in
not.
In your order, in the order you choose, how about that?
Actually, I only have two comments to make. The first relates to the special monthly comp issue. The government concluded by saying that the combined rating can never be a single rating. And yet, by regulation at 4.16A4, a combined rating for multiple injuries incurred in a single action will be considered to be one disability. So it seems that the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. And ultimately, that seems to me to be what this argument boils down to on special monthly comp. There's a way to do it to allow the benefit, and there certainly has been a way to do it to take the benefit away. That just simply isn't correct, and their reliance upon the general counsel opinion, particularly when apparently they have a contrary general counsel's opinion, which was not cited in their brief, for a different interpretation as it relates to 1114S, certainly seems to me to be a compelling argument in favor of Mr. Bradley's position. The next comment that I want to make.
Let me just ask you a question right there, Mr.
Yes.
Carpenter. With regard to the starting place on all of this is 1114S. And if it's clear on its face, that's the end of the matter. Mm-hmm. If it's not clear on its face, assume that it's not clear mm-hmm. on its face, is 3.350 then a reasonable regulation by the Secretary? You haven't raised it in your brief directly,
I don't think. I'm not sure, given the discussion that I've just been privy to about the General Counsel's opinion and the amendment of the other section, that they can reconcile those two things as they attempted to do an argument in order to say that there is a position that this court can give deference to, because it appears, at least from the discussion, that the General Counsel has taken two different positions in relationship to TDIU and 1114S. So as a consequence, the predicate for that deference would be that is something that this court can defer to when the Secretary has offered a different view in the promulgation of a different regulation based upon a different general counsel's opinion. So it seems to me that although they might meet the threshold for deference, I'm not sure that they would be able to attain the deference based upon their regulatory record.
Is the addition to the regulation of a 100% rating requirement contrary to the statutory provision of total?
I believe it is, yes.
Why?
Because total describes the right to compensation at a total rating under 1114J. And as I believe this court correctly discussed with general counsel, the end result is simply, are you entitled to receive total compensation? There is the regulatory means for obtaining that total rating based upon an award of individual a determination of individual unemployability. Consequently, you are totally rated for that disability if that is in fact determinable. If it's not determinable, then obviously you can't qualify. But to say across the board you're not because of the nature of having been granted a total rating is unreasonable. The final comment that I wanted to make.
Follow up on that thread. Okay.
Yes, okay.
Are you saying then that the Secretary could not write a regulation that used the word total and did not allow you to apply 1114S? Did I finish that question?
I think so, Your Honor. And I think the response is that they could not, because of their pre-existing regulations at 3.340, 3.321, and 4.16, which provide for extra scheduler rating, so that you move to that J, notwithstanding the fact that you don't meet the scheduler requirements, or that you meet certain scheduler predicates in order to get the J rating. The J rating is a total rating. You're rated total under J. You are not rated 100%, notwithstanding the reference in 1155 and notwithstanding the reference in their regulation. You are totally compensated for that disability. And that's the predicate under the first step of 1114S. And then you have to meet the other disabilities for combined of 60.
But regardless of the Secretary's inconsistent, assuming they are inconsistent regulations, wouldn't we have to find that Congress meant something by total and that it meant more than 100%? To say the Secretary couldn't write a regulation limiting it to 100%?
No, Your Honor. I think you simply have to accept what Congress wrote in the earlier section of 1114 at 1114J, that you get total compensation when you get to J. And there's a way to get it 100% schedulely under 1155, and there's a way to get it under the regulations.
So that's what I'm saying. We'd have to conclude that Congress meant by the use of the word total, you could get it any way you got total.
I don't think you can interpret 1114J any other way. I mean, because you have to give them a total rating when they meet those prerequisites under the regulation.
But, counsel, why couldn't
you? You don't give them 100% scheduler rating. The VA told you that. Sorry?
Why, as I look at J, or 1114 actually, mm-hmm. it's a progression.
Yes.
And it stops at 90 and ends with total.
Correct.
Okay.
And if you look at the payment schedule, you find that 90% really isn't 90% of 100%. You know, so I mean, we're really talking about legal fictions built on legal fictions, but the reality is that when you get to J, you get a total rate of compensation, which is the equivalent of a 100% scheduler rating. When Congress wrote S, it didn't say that we're going to make any other statement other than totally rated, a disability totally rated.
What would make the Secretary's interpretation of that statutory section equivalent to 100% unreasonable?
Because it would exclude the ability to get a compensation under J under unemployability. It would say you cannot be rated totally under J and get that unless you have a 100% scheduler. And that simply is inconsistent with J.
Well, why wouldn't it include a total disability? TDIU and or 100%?
Well, I'm sorry. Perhaps we're saying the same thing, but 100% and total are the same thing under J, but Congress did not use the word 100% in differentiating what you get for compensation under J. They said you get it for total. And in S, they said when you're totally rated, that's the first step of being able to get special monthly compensation under that particular portion of that statutory scheme.
Time is up, but I'll take questions if you have them. Dr. Davis? No. Case is submitted.
Thank you very much.
Down in great counsel.
All rise.